Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello. Well, here we go. We are going to be chatting about a delightful book, and it is with Diana Robb. It is titled Hummingbird. I don't know about you, but I have an especially strong affection for those little tiny birds because they have the privilege and my privilege of observing them in my own home backyard. It's just a delight having them around, as it is a delight having Diana Robb as a guest. Her memoir is titled Hummingbird, but she has this subtle message subtitle that goes along with that hummingbird. It's Messages from My Ancestors. And her background, well, she's got quite a bit. She's a workshop facilitator. She's a poet. She's won awards for her writing. She is what likes to be called, she likes to be called a thought leader and a survivor. So, Diana, you have a very interesting life, and writing is a passion of yours. When you started putting Hummingbird together, it wasn't just a trip down memory lane. It was a story, really, about how you recognize certain people in your family having such a tremendous impact on you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Donna. Thank you so much for having me again. I think you've had me for a couple of my books in the past.
This one you've dedicated to your children, grandchildren, and future grandchildren. Well, you call it a memoir, so you're leaving a legacy, a written legacy for them. You say that hummingbirds inspired you to write this. How so?
Well, the book was written during the pandemic, and I was in my writing studio at home, and every day a hummingbird visited the red flowers right outside my window, and it would stop and stare at me, and I thought, you know, there's a message going on here, and I'm just going to pay attention to it, because I believe we get messages all the time. And my grandmother, who was one of my caretakers and my primary caretaker, died when I was about 10, and I've had a photo of her on my desk for many, many years, because she's inspired the writer in me. She taught me how to type on a typewriter. And so she was coming at a time when I really needed some guidance, and she was speaking to me through the hummingbird.
You have a poem that you wrote, Diana, and it is about the hummingbird. I've fallen in love with a hummingbird, the way she arrives each day as the red flowers outside my studio and moves among the petals as if the next has more to offer. The nectar, oh, it oozes so gently while other birds nuzzle their beaks in curiosity. She might think I'm foolish to stare at her in this wonder and amazement as she performs so naturally, and I pretend to be writing a new poem, beseeching her for inspiration. But before I can grab her, she's gone. On to the next chore, whatever it might be, maybe reaching for the heavens, or seeking her ancestral friends who hold answers from the beyond, which in the end is all we want. That was quite a lovely poem. It complements what you just shared as the inspiration for this book. Your grandmother was a very powerful presence in your life. Your mother was someone that wasn't very, well, she was very self-centered, and having a family wasn't really something that she really wanted to be bothered with. But your grandmother filled a void that your mother really didn't concern herself about, from what you've written. And those times that you had with her were quite precious, weren't they?
Yes, they were very, very precious. And, you know, I think the feelings and the learnings of early childhood stay with us for the rest of our lives. You know, she was my caretaker, and she actually took her life when I was 10. And it was a very traumatic time for me. And, of course, you don't realize very often how trauma affects us later on in life. But I think it really hit me, you know, when I was writing my first memoir, Regina's Closet, which was about her and finding her journal. And I realized what a loss it was to me for losing her.
You say writing for you is a form of consolation. And I can understand that. I know I've been journaling forever, it seems like. And this is something that, for so many people, it is a healing tool. It is a process. And when you were a child, this was something that your grandmother actually encouraged you to do. Was it not?
Yes. Yes, that's true. She kept a journal. She was orphaned in World War One, and so she kept a journal. She was orphaned at age 11, and she kept a journal very early on. And then when she passed, my mother, who was an English major at the time, didn't really know what to do with me because, you know, it was the 60s and therapy wasn't a big thing. So she went out and bought me a journal and told me to write my feelings. And so, yes, I learned from a very early age that writing can be healing. And I love teaching others the same power of the writing process.
You said you feel like you have a very deep aspect of intuition within you, and you, as an adult, visited a community of Casadaga near Orlando, Florida, where there was a lot of mediums, and you had the opportunity to meet with an older medium. What was it that you experienced with that person?
Yes, that was thank you for, first of all, thank you so much, Donna, for reading the book, because I've done so many interviews, and I can tell when the interviewer has read the book, and that is definitely a story that is close to my heart. So it was when I was working on the first memoir, Regina's Closet, and since my grandmother was orphaned in World War One, I never really get to see the town where she was raised, and I wanted to know more about her. So I did go to Casadaga Psychic Community, and I was told to walk around and find the house that pulled me in, and there was a white house with a picket fence, and I opened the fence and walked up the stairs and knocked on the door, and this woman came, an older woman, looked actually a little bit like my grandmother, and she said, "Come on in." And what she told me was, she had a lot of revelatory things, but one of the things she told me is, you know, your grandmother said that it wasn't your fault. And, you know, this is without me mentioning anything about my grandmother. That she just felt that, and she also told me some messages from my father. So I think since that day, I really believed in the power of intuition and mediums.
Mm-hmm. It does make a difference when you have those experiences, especially when there's been no conversation, you're not from the area. You know, so often people will say, well, they can do research. And
yeah.
I know that just doesn't wash. But it's fascinating, and when people have the abilities, it's quite exceptional, and it is very meaningful. And that is why the development of mediumship takes so long to really occur with most people if they're wanting to develop their skills. With this statement that your grandmother was a seer, your grandmother was a very gifted woman, obviously, and you had a lot of questions as an adult, but when you were a child, you actually discovered your grandmother, and she was dead. And in your young mind, that was very, very, that wasn't supposed to happen. And it was really quite a heavy trauma for you, because she was so dear and near to your heart. And this was really, really tough. And as an adult, this was something that brought up a lot of questions that you had not asked as a child, because you couldn't. How would you know how to ask the questions?
No, I didn't know. I didn't know.
And she, I don't think she committed suicide, but she was taking a drug, Valium, that had been given to her by a doctor. And that is what caused her death.
Yeah, well, you know, the death certificate did say overdose of sleeping pills. But, you know, in a sense, we really don't know. We do know that she was depressed, and she went to her family physician, and the physician gave her Valium. That was, of course, a very big drug at the time, and perhaps she was trying to fall asleep. One pill didn't work, another didn't work, and then, you know, we don't know how many were in the bottle. You know, we have no idea. So we've assumed that it was suicide, but perhaps it was not. But we do know that when you're depressed, you know, you do tend to reach for anything that'll take you out of that that feeling. And one of the reasons she got depressed is I started becoming very independent. I was 10. I started walking to school by myself, and she felt like she didn't really have a place in the house or in her universe anymore. I was kind of the reason she was living. So that's the explanation my parents gave me. You know, I don't know how accurate it really was, but it makes a lot of sense to me.
You talk about visitations in your book, in the quote by Ralph Ellison, "Some people are your relatives, but others are your ancestors, and you choose the ones you want to have as your ancestors. You create yourself out of those values." And I think that, yes, it can be with your ancestors. You can inherit certain things. But I think we also create ourselves from the environments we're in and from those people that we're very, very close to that are very meaningful, whether it's a teacher or a member of family. It can even be a perfect stranger. I think we're created by both components. You write about the visitations. What happened? What made you put this chapter together?
Well, I think I mentioned early on in the book that ancestors can be, as you mentioned, mentors, teachers, people that you've admired over the years. They could be places, like I'm very inspired by Big Sur, or they can be ancestors. So I believe in terms of visitations, if we pay attention, we have visitations, whether it's a butterfly that comes, whether it's a hummingbird, whether it's a flashing light. It's all about being present and just noting what is coming and seeing what the messages are that are coming forth. You know, I just recently taught a workshop on this, and I thought, oh, these people, I'm going to have to start from scratch and teach them how to connect with their ancestors. But I was amazed how many people already are connecting with their ancestors through signals that they receive on a daily basis.
Oh, yes.
So it's pretty common. Yeah.
It is. It really, really is. There was a gentleman that I interviewed just recently, and he was saying how the penny was a symbol in the family to a certain relative. You know, this was something that they would find pennies in different places that they might be coming out of the grocery store, and there's a penny on the ground right in front of them. Or there's a penny on the chest just drawers that didn't have a penny there before. So it's a form of materialization in a way. And the other people will say it's a dove. And you, and your family relationship, your grandfather or your father, whoever it is, the dove is a symbol for them. And I've got a friend. Her father comes in. It's like the messages come through the form of a dove. It really, it is something that in the indigenous cultures, this is very normal. This is very natural. They do not laugh at anybody that says this. And it's very comforting. I think of a man that had passed away many, many years ago who was of a very high church positioning. His name was Bishop Pike. And after his son committed suicide, there were things that happened, and he was in total denial about anything relative to that. And he did a 180-degree shift because his son communicated with him. And there's so many different ways that we get messages. Mm-hmm. You know, you could have ladybugs that show up, and you don't have ladybugs in your environment. And here's this little itsy-bitsy person called a ladybug that is right in your environment, letting you know they're there, and then they're gone. And if you study any of the cultures, it's amazing how the symbologies are so important. That's why sometimes among certain peoples, they'll have a totem for a clan, a tribe. They will pick it. And they do it for a reason, because of some very special happening. And so many times people say, that's silly. Well, it all depends on what you understand. I don't think it's silly at all.
No, no. It really does get down to your belief system and also your experiences. You know, there might be someone that's skeptical and until this happens to them, and then they have a whole new, you know, worldview about it. So I think it might sound way out there and woo-woo to some people, but I think if they really focus on receiving those messages, that they will.
Mm-hmm. Well, your grandfather lived for a number of years after your grandmother died, and he became a substitute for her. And when he passed away, that was because of an operation, and that affected you very deeply. So you have had these experiences where you've experienced these passings of loved ones who were very near and dear to you, and the adaptations in adulthood that you've gone through relative to those experiences, it's quite profound how you were saying you suffered from a depression during the middle of COVID, and you called a shaman friend in Arizona. Mm-hmm. How did he help you?
Well, he helped me in a way that, well, first of all, his presence is very healing. And the reason I was dealing with the depression at the time was I was getting my second cancer diagnosis, and the doctors wanted to treat me, and I was refusing treatment. I rather wanted to go the integrative route. So he helped me in the sense of his, you know, he also was very inspired by Native American rituals. We did a lot of ritual ceremonies. I tried mushrooms under controlled situations, and he played music, and it was very, very healing. Unfortunately, I had a little bit of a bad experience because I had a heart issue, as a probably coincidental to the intensity of the experience I had, but it really did snap me out of my depression, and I had a very low dose, and so I just never wanted to go on antidepressants, and I know that now it's more and more prevalent out there that people are doing these journeys to help them deal with depression or any other kind of a mental health situations that could be challenging for them.
Mm-hmm. It's very significant, and it's wonderful that we're able to talk about that and be open about it, because it's a very human experience. And
it is a very human experience.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I was a hippie in the 60s, and I certainly did a, you know, some hallucinogenics, and which really transformed me. But, you know, of course, there's been a big hiatus, and they've been, you know, not really accepted by society. But we're coming around. We're coming back to all that kind of ways of healing.
I think there's a lot more that's becoming of the discipline of saying we have to deal with the whole body. We have to deal with the mind, the emotions, the spirit, and the physical self. All of those, we are a total package. You just don't deal with the physical without dealing with the spiritual, mental, and emotional, because that's very significant in association. It's all part of, again, the package of who we are. And this is, in your book, you talk about developing your own intuition. And this is something that I think, and I've encouraged people in all the years I've been doing my own work, encouraging them to realize that this is something that belongs to them. This is not out in outer space somewhere. It is right here, right now, present with each and every living form of life. And it is part of our survival package. So you have become much more comfortable with that side of yourself, have you not?
Yes, I have. And that was, I think I have my grandmother to thank for that. She gave me those messages, of course, when I knew her, but I was just 10 when she passed. But when the hummingbird came and she started talking to me again, she reminded me to follow my heart and follow my intuition and to trust it. Because very often I think our intuition does speak to us, but we don't pay attention. So she was telling me over and over again, just go with your, just trust yourself. She said, sometimes your head can confuse you and, you know, but you need to lead with your heart and your intuition. And I'm also a big believer in that. And I have 3 children and 6 grandchildren. I try to instill in that, you know, that in all of them. But it takes a lot of practice, you know. Nothing is kind of, for some people it's very natural. Other people I have to work at it.
Mm-hmm. Your subtitle on your book, Hummingbird, is Messages from My Ancestors. And you devote a section of your book regarding ancestors. And one of the things that you learned about your grandmother is that she, just like you, was born into a family environment where the mother didn't want you or didn't want her. And the same with you. So there is a generation skipped here where there is this link with your grandmother, not with your mother, but with your grandmother, that's especially strong. Now, some people might say, well, that's not unusual. It depends on the situation. So you had this connection with her that not even your mother had with her. It's fascinating.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, my mother was very dependent on her. My mother mourned for many years when she died. She was only in her mid-30s. But we definitely had a connection that was that surpassed time for sure. And, you know, as a 10-year-old, I don't know that I even realized it at the time until she passed. You know, sometimes it takes, you know, it took me 40 years to write the book about her. So sometimes you really have to reflect on, and you have to be more experienced with life to really understand, looking back, what we've learned and how we've transformed.
In your book, and I'm going to read it directly, you say, we have to create our own narrative of our own life without holding on to all our ancestors' grief and tribulations. A healthier way is to send previous generations love and compassion while living our own lives. You say it's all very bittersweet. And you related this to depression, but this is something that even science is coming forth and recognizing, because so many times there can be information about ancestors you have no knowledge about, but there's this heaviness that one feels. And it comes sometimes from your own culture, but there is that people go through, and it is passed along. And that is what you found about your grandmother and about the ancestral lineage that you had. How did you become aware of that? Someone listening to me chatting with you, how did you become aware of that?
Well, I read a lot of books. I mean, the famous one is The Body Keeps Score. And you might be familiar with by Bessel van der Kolk. And he, you know, he says just the body remembers everything. The body just remembers. And so, and I'm a firm believer, the older I get, I'm turning 70 this year, the older I get, the more I realize how true that is. Now, during my mushroom journey, my father was a Holocaust survivor. I had severe chest pain, and the reason I had the chest pain is I was yelling at the Nazis for killing all my father's family. And I think I got so involved in it that and what I was told by my shaman after was that my depression really, and the reality was that I was carrying around my father's pain all those years in my heart, and that's why I was depressed. I'd never voiced it. I'd never talked about it. He never talked about it, but I was carrying his pain, and that really was not my pain to carry. And so I think that was the release that I had during my journey that was very revealing to me.
This, I think, is especially significant. And even today, There are people that will have traumas that they do not share. Their family members have no idea that these traumas have occurred. And maybe they find a journal like you did. You were given the journal of your grandmother. There is so much, many times, that we just don't have a clue about. And that is passed along. And it is something, my goodness, you have people that get heart transplants and suddenly they have new habits. They have habits that belong to the person that their heart was put into that individual's body. These stories come out, and so often it's ignored. But we carry it. When you think about the heart, that is what keeps the body going, is the heart. And so when the heart is heavy with grief, it's working overtime. It carries a huge burden. And it's something that they're even finding scientifically. When people carry a lot of grief inside themselves, they'll often develop illnesses.
Yeah, they've known that actually for years, that in terms of grief is very often carried in the lungs. And so and you're talking about transplants. I unfortunately just lost one of my brother-in-laws very young at 62, but he had two double lung transplants, and he did really well, actually. He just passed away because of the side effects of the drug. But what I always wondered when he got these transplants, I said, don't you want to know the people that you got them from? And he said, no, I really don't. But I always, in the back of my mind, I wondered, I wondered if he assumed any of the characteristics of these people. I didn't live near him, so I didn't really see him on a daily basis. But I was always very curious about that. Because, you're carrying a very vital organ of another human being who you never met, it's very interesting. The whole idea is very interesting.
You give a quote by Henri Matisse. There are always flowers for those who want to see them. And that, I think, is a very positive statement. Because how we think, how we feel, how we share our life with others, what we internalize that we may not choose to share, all of that is a very significant part of life. And I think you stated it quite well earlier in that you said you are turning 70. And so it is your awareness that you could not have understood many things when you were younger because you didn't have any life experience. And now you have a lot of life experience. And so you make your choices and you base those choices on what it is that you want to give a priority to. That's what I call freedom.
Yes, I agree with you, Donna.
I think that is freedom. You are a senior. You bring out a statement that someone made to you because your mother had gotten COVID and she was in a facility. And this nurse said to you that seniors don't always get fevers because their bodies don't fight the virus in the same way. That is a fascinating statement because that's true. It's very true. It will affect people in young, middle age, elderly. It depends on them individually. It really is a fascinating thing. And a lot of seniors didn't get sick.
Right.
Many did. Right. Many did, and they usually were in a closed environment, like a facility. I'm not saying all of them, but the body works in its own way. And you have found this very, very much in your own personal experience, especially with cancer and various other situations you've gone through. Your book, Hummingbird, Messages from My Ancestors, we just barely scratched the surface of it, but your book is very succinct. When you finished writing it, what were your self-perceptions that you maybe didn't have before? And what was it that made you feel like this was an important thing for you to share?
That's an excellent question. I think as a writer, and this is my 14th book, as a writer, I realize that if books just pour out of me, then it means that it's a book that I have to write. So this book basically just poured out of me. You know, some books I might labor over more, and then I realize, oh, maybe I'm forcing something that shouldn't be forced. So that's partially the answer. The other answer is I really wanted to share my knowledge with people who could benefit from it and, you know, who might be wanting to connect with ancestors. And I think also during this time when there's so much chaos in the world, I think a lot of us are reaching for wisdom. Like, where is the wisdom? Where are the wise people? Where are the Martin Luther Kings? Where are the, you know, Gandhis? Where are those people that have offered us wisdom? Maybe they are our ancestors, and if we have one of those, let's just connect with them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think we need some inspiration.
I think that's very true. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the reasons why shamanism and various areas of learning are coming forth. They were disregarded, thrown in the trash can. The popular opinions were they have no value, they're voodoo hoodoo, and that's not the case at all. There is mm-hmm. wisdom in many, many cultures. And I think people, like you just said, are wanting to reconnect with that they can resonate with, whether it is another culture that they have no, you might say, biological association with, or one that they do have an association with. I think that's one of the reasons why the Ancestry.com and the other organizations are so popular, because people are saying, I want to know about the legacy that preceded me because I went into this family. What is it that I can relate with? And I think that's one of the reasons why the program Roots became so popular, because people found out about parts of themselves and their families and their legacies, and they go, wow, that explains a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Not unlike what you experienced.
Yeah, there are people that don't want to know. You know, there are people that, you know, if they come from a history of trauma, some people are a little bit resistant and abused and that sort of thing. But sometimes if you go further back, you can find, you know, you might find some gems, you know, we don't know.
Mm-hmm. Very, very true. Diana Rabb, your website, if people are wanting to do some research about what you've written and your book, Hummingbird, a memoir, Messages from My Ancestors, is a lovely, lovely read. It's your name, and that's DianaRaab, like boy, .com. I want to thank you for being my guest.
Thank you so much, Donna, for having me, and thank you, listeners, for listening, and I have also a monthly newsletter that you can sign up for on my website, and all kinds of interesting information on it, from writing prompts to books to read. And so I hope you sign up and have a beautiful evening.
You too. It's been a pleasure having you as a guest
Thank
again,
you.
Diana.
Thanks, Donna.
You're very
Thank
welcome.
You
We're saying goodbye to Diana Rabb, and we're moving right along, but check out her website, Diana Rabb, RAAB.com. Well, we're taking a little bit of a break. I will take a sip of tea, and then I'll be back with you in just a bit. 253-582-5597. If you'd like to chat, give me a buzz. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For current information regarding my email newsletter, programming, and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to MrsSebo'sClassics.com. This is Donna Sebo. If you or someone you know is an author and would like to be interviewed on the Donna Sebo Show or Warriors for Peace, please send a copy of the publication along with contact information, phone number, email, and website to the Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. That's the Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. Thank you. Well, we have a wonderful lineup of people on the Donna Sebo Show, as well as Warriors for Peace. So what have we got coming up? Well, we are going to be talking tomorrow evening with Eileen St. Laurent. Oh, her book, Southern Light. It is a wonderful read, and it really, really relates to what I call the Southern disposition. And she lives in the South. She lives in Mississippi. So we're going to be talking with her tomorrow evening. And then next week, we have a wonderful lineup, Writing the Sacred with Ray McGinnis. He's in Canada. And then I'm going to be playing the audio of my television show on money, the world of money, challenges and opportunities. Now, my guests are Lori Sackler and Francis Raham. Of course, you can watch the television interview, and you can see both of these wonderful women, and it's, I think, just a great show. But also, I wanted to play the audio in case you do not have the opportunity to watch the video. So you're going to hear that on Tuesday. And then on Wednesday, we're going to be talking with Richard Schoen, and this is a man, he's Chinese American. His mother was from China, and she left a phenomenal legacy with him. Took him 10 years to bring it all together. It's a trilogy of books. It's called Spring Flower, A Tale of Rivers. And we're going to be just discussing the first one. And then Advice to Ninth Graders with Victor Trillo. This is about a very, very special organization that works with young people who have family members that are incarcerated. And there's a special club. It's an organization that is nationwide. It is so special. And then, well, that's going to be for next week, and we've got so much more. Now, you can always check in on my newsletter to find out who's coming up on the shows. And also on my network page, we have the posting. I'll be fried up about each of the authors. There's the author's showcase. There's also the player that plays the latest 13 to 15 hours of programming 24/7. So if you've missed anything and you say, gee, I wish I could have listened to it, Donna, don't worry about it. It's in the archives. So it's on the player as well as in the archives as well. And then we're going to be talking on Valentine's Day. We are going to be talking about the flight of the Bon Monks on Warriors for Peace. This is with Harvey Rice and Jackie Cole. It's an amazing conversation about these men that survived the invasion of Tibet. And one man in particular who was an inspiration to literally thousands of people that witnessed a horrific genocidal massacre of their own people. So that and more is evolving, and we just have a tremendous lineup of people. And I've said this to you before, and that is that I consider it a privilege, my being able to do what I do, because it has enriched my life, and I'm able to share it with anybody who's willing to listen. The stories, the information, the knowledge, because I interview people from all kinds of environments, whether they're scientists, whether they're rich and famous, it doesn't make any difference if they have material that is going to empower you as an individual. I like to share it because I learned, and I still learn repeatedly, that what you don't know can hurt you. And I say this because there are many situations in my life that I went through because I was naive, because I was unaware, I was ignorant of certain areas of knowledge, and I didn't have anybody that I knew to ask. And consequently, I bumbled along Well, that's part of life. That's what we do. We do the best we can with what we have. But it is wonderful when you expand your mind, and that's the gift that reading brings to you. I don't care if it's a magazine. I don't care if you go to the library and you're listening to audiobooks. It doesn't make any difference. Books are important. Reading is important. Education is important. And understanding that there's not just one absolute. Many times there's facets of knowledge that are ignored by people because they will say, well, this is the way so-and-so does it, and if that's the way they do it, that's the way it has to be done. We don't progress as an individual, nor as a community or as a culture or even globally without opening our eyes, ears, and all of our senses saying, what other options could there be? Sort of like taking medicine. Some people can take a medicine and not have any side effects. Other people can be killed by it. What is it? It's the individual chemistry. It is the way that our bodies use that medicine. And on the other hand, it's the same thing with knowledge. So many times throughout history, the more you learn about history, the more you realize is that we get ourselves into a great deal of trouble because we like to compartmentalize things as human beings, saying there's only one way to do that, only one way to do anything, and that's not true. So that's why reading and education is so important. Donna Sebo here, 253-582-5597. If you ever wondered why you have been told, maybe you weren't, but I certainly was, keep your elbows off the table. Well, I don't adhere to that 100% anymore, especially if I'm having a conversation with someone and I'm leaning forward and I'm really wanting to hear what they have to say because I'm interested in who they are. Well, do you know what? It seems like in the Western culture, according to some research, that table manners, as we know of them today, started coming about in the Middle Ages. Well, the elbow situation, it has something to do with the personal boundaries of people. Have you ever noticed when you're on a plane, those seats, a key seat, keep getting narrower and narrower? And I'm a small person, so when I have to keep my elbows and my hands and arms and right close to my sides, actually in front of me, because there's no space to rest my arms due to the narrowness of the seats and the environments that we're in on a plane, well, that makes sense. And when people were all together, you don't want to wave a fork or a knife in somebody's direction, or you don't want to reach across somebody's chest for whatever it is that's there. And you don't want people sneezing around you without distancing themselves from the environment that they're in. And there was a gentleman by the name of Norbert Elias, and he said it was something that created often among people a social distance between classes. And as the various classes intermixed, then other members of the various classes adopted them. And it's has all to do, the keeping the elbows off the table is about distancing the self. And if you sit out and you've got your arms sprawled out, you're taking over somebody else's space. So, Miss Manners, and I think you've all heard about Miss Manners, she said, we're very fortunate, and I don't know when she said this, but this is what was quoted, admitting that the fugitive single elbow near the plate is no longer punishable by hanging, it's a good idea to keep one's arms close to the body so that they stay out of your neighbor's ribs. I just thought I'd share that little bit of trivia with you. So many things in life that come down from our ancestors, and there used to be training on this. Even in school, there were things that you were taught so that you would have, quote unquote, the social graces that would enable you to enter into just about any environment and be comfortable. However, a lot of that has gone by the wayside. And you see people wondering, What part of the cave did you come out of when you don't even know how to be courteous? Corporations often pay a substantial amount of money to educate their employees when they observe them not having manners and not knowing how to be social in environments, especially with salespeople, because this is something that's very important. And I will tell you, in areas on the East Coast, your manners, you are labeled by your manners. It is really quite significant. And don't let anybody ever tell you otherwise, because it is. Certain environments, those manners may not be as important, but believe me, they do. And that's why it's important that children get training when they're younger, so they know about courtesy, how to address people, how to interact. It takes training. And that is something that people get if those around them know how to do it. Donna Sebo here, 253-582-5597. Well, I wanted to share something with you. You know, for those of you that listen to me frequently, you know I love food. Sometimes I wish I were about 7 feet tall so I could eat five times more than I do, but that's not the case. I'm on the short side, so I have to be very thoughtful about what I ingest, because it really, my body's very, very efficient, and I am petite, and so consequently, it doesn't take much to make me look like a bowling ball, if that's what I was careless about. One of the wonderful flavors that I really enjoy is mint. And it is great as a tea. It is used in so many dishes. I remember the first time I ever had the Mediterranean dish, tabbouleh, and I fixed it. And mint, fresh mint, was very much a part of it. And the flavor was just refreshing. Tabbouleh, fixed in the Middle Eastern way, is absolutely refreshing, especially in the summer. It's a wonderful, wonderful summer salad to have. And it just, the mint is magical in it. But I did not have an awareness of the nutritional value of mint. It is a good source of vitamin C, B2, manganese, copper, and there's a lot of phytonutrients in mint that are very good for settling your digestion. In fact, I remember learning years ago that after a meal, if you had eaten a little bit too much, instead of having, let's say, a cup of coffee or a cup of tea, having a mint tea. Very soothing to the digestive system. And calories, forget it. There's hardly anything in the way of calories. And mint is grown year-round. Now, you can grow it in your own yard, and it's good to do it in a pot because it can take over your whole garden. Mint is known for that. But it is just absolutely delicious. And sun tea, I found that fresh mint leaves, and I had a pot of mint that was just wonderful, and I would cut off the leaves and I would put them into a container, a big container that would hold water and a bunch of black tea bags, and the mint was put in there. Oh my goodness, it was so refreshing. But you can do that with hot tea as well. And in the cold, damp months like we're having in the Pacific Northwest at this time, it's cold and it's damp, and a good mint tea is so refreshing. It really is great. And I've got a friend that she has mint plants, and she makes a point of drying them so she can have the mint all year round. And it's great. Mint jelly, I don't know a lot of people that eat mint jelly, but it's wonderful. It's very, very good. Mint and chocolate, oh my gracious, that is very refreshing. So you have all of that. Well, I've got a recipe that I was surprised, and it had to do with tea. Now, in Morocco, and this is a Moroccan mint tea recipe, they have their sweet tea, and it is something that is very, very refreshing. And what they use is 2 tablespoons of Chinese green tea, or what they call Chinese gunpowder tea. And then you have 5 cups of boiling water, 1 large bunch of fresh mint that's been washed, and then 1 cup of sugar. Now, yes, that makes a sweet tea. You don't have to use that much sugar unless you want to. But you just steep the tea for about 5 minutes and then add your sugar and stir it thoroughly. And in the Middle East, they serve tea in glasses or in cups, you know, that are made of glass. It's something where they really enjoy their tea. But that is a Moroccan mint tea recipe, and it is so good. It's so refreshing. And another tea that I like that is good is mint. In fact, I know of someone that was really not feeling well, and I said, why don't you get some fresh ginger? I'm a big tea drinker. Get some fresh ginger, grate the fresh ginger, put that grated ginger into a nice size pot, have your black tea, put it in there, pour boiling water over it. You can add sugar if you want. I like it without the sugar. And just let it steep. And, oh, I'm telling you, it helps your autoimmune system like you would not believe. And it is very, very healthy for you. Ginger is another component that I think goes a long way, especially during winter, goes a long way to keeping our immune system healthy. Well, I wanted to share that with you, those two different teas, because, again, I'm a tea drinker, but you know that fresh mint with chocolate, hot chocolate with a little bit of that fresh mint in it? It is really, really good. Well, I wanted to share with you a story about the thin one. Now, these are stories that were given to an author, Michael Norman. He loves to collect all kinds of stories. And this one was related to him by a woman by the name of Jean. And she lives in Glasgow. She said, or did live in Glasgow, excuse me. When she was a child, they had a place in Glasgow as part of a tenement. And she said, we were above a commercial building. Well, that wasn't unusual. Even here in the United States, you'd have businesses in the lower part of a building and apartments above, because often the owners of businesses lived in one of those apartments, and it was convenient to go to and from work. All they had to do was go up and down the stairs. Well, she said that there were 3 upper floors that had 3 residential apartments, and there was 1 stairway that led to all of them. And she said, we had a large window that let in a lot of natural light during the day. And, of course, they had electricity. And she said, below us was a grouping of 3 apartments. And there were middle-aged people there, 2 brothers, bachelors, and a widowed woman. And they had come over to Scotland from Ireland. And she said they were just wonderful people. She really enjoyed them. Now, there were all of these different conversations they would have with their neighbors. And she said, at the time when I was growing up, you never, ever called anybody by their first name. It was always Mr. or Mrs. or Miss. Ms., just the MS, wasn't in existence at that time. Well, one of the men that lived on this, or in the middle apartment section of this 3-story apartment unit, was nicknamed the Thin One, because it just, the guy was tall, was thin, and then his brother was called the Other One, and people would refer to them in that way. Well, the one that was so thin, Jean saw on a regular basis. And when she'd come home from school, he was on his way going into work, and they'd always talk to each other, and they would talk about what was happening. She would share with him what was happening at home or about her dog, the normal stuff we share with people. Well, one day, she came home from school, and her mother said to her, the thin one is sick. His sister called the doctor. Well, she asked, well, what's wrong with him? They said, they don't know. He's having some tests done. Well, her mother started spending more time with this family that was below them. And this was expressed, and she'd talk about it when she'd come up after the rest of the family came in, because each member of the family was working their own hours. And the mother expressed to the family how she was very concerned about this man because he wasn't doing well. He was quite ill. And one night, or one afternoon, I should say, her mother, when Jean came home, her mother said, "Jean, you need to go to the Catholic church down the road, and you need to go and get the priest, because the thin one is very sick." And this was something that surprised Jean. She said she knew all about the priests, and she knew where they lived, so she went as fast as she possibly could. And she wondered, "I wonder if the priest might be out visiting some other people," because that's what they did. She ends up at the facility where the priest lived. And the housekeeper answered the doorbell, which Jean was really ringing quite frequently. And Jean gave her the message, and the housekeeper immediately went inside. And there was more than one priest at the church, and so she got one of the priests, and he didn't ask Jean any questions. He just grabbed his hat and his jacket, and they went immediately. Well, she said she was young. She didn't realize the significance of the priest showing up. And she said later on, a few days go by, and she's coming home from school. And she sees the thin one coming out like it had so many times. He looked at her and he smiled and he waved and she waved back. And she said, "Oh, I'm so glad you're better." And he looked pale. Well, he had been sick. And he was wearing his working clothes, and she thought, "Wow, you don't look good. You really shouldn't go back to work." But she said, "I liked him a lot, so maybe my prayers have been answered. He was okay," and he just stood there looking at her, smiling. And she asked the question, "Will you be all right going back to work?" And he didn't say anything, and he nodded. She said, "Oh, I'm so glad. See you later." And off she goes, and he raised his hand, waved farewell to her, and he continued on his way out like he had done regularly for a long period of time. Well, she gets home, and she tells her mom. She said, "Oh, I'm so happy the thin one is so much better." Her mother said, "What do you mean, better?" She said, "Oh, Mom, I saw him. He was on the stairs. He waved at me. He told, you know, he let me know because I asked him if he was feeling better, and he nodded and said he was." Her mother said, "I want you to sit down. I want you to tell me again exactly what happened on the stairs." So she told her. She said, "Daughter, I don't understand. He's dead." Jean said, "He can't be. I just talked to him. He's alive. He looks a little pale, but he's alive." She said, "You must have seen him just seconds after he died." She looked at her mom. She said, "Mom, was that a ghost I saw?" Her mother said, "I don't know." But what she felt in reflection years later, she said, "I was really surprised I was able to see a ghost in broad daylight. It happens." Mm-hmm. It really does. Donna Sebo here. Remember always that you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Life is an adventure. And there are so many that will be so afraid of talking about death and dying, and there is so much of a stigma with that. Well, it's all going to be, every one of us is going to die at some time. It's about how you live your life. It's how you express in your life. Life is a gift. And in living it, if you want to get scared, give yourself a 15-minute timer. Say, "Oh my God, I don't want to die." Okay, give yourself 15 minutes being really frightened. And then when the timer goes off, turn around and say, "Okay, that's enough of that. Now it's time to be alive." That is what is important. Live life with an energy, an enthusiasm. Don't be down in the dumps. Realize that you have a choice, and that choice is yours to make, not for someone else to dictate to you. makes a difference. I'll be talking with you tomorrow evening. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.